listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by API. Now from the Nowcast Network studios, here's Mike.
Hey, welcome to the Audio Nowcast. My name is Mike Rodriguez, and before we get going, let me introduce the guys. Over here, on my right, we've got Diego.
Hey, Mike. It's been a while.
Yeah.
It's busy.
Next to him, we've got Scott Gershon.
Good evening, Mike.
Scott, it's been a while. over here on my left, we've got the one and only Rob Arbiter.
Hello there, Mike. It hasn't been a while. I've seen you recently.
Well, yeah.
Semi-recently. More recently than these two.
Guys, it seems like it's been a while, though. I mean, it's probably been about 4 or 5 weeks.
We're taking a creative break.
Yeah, no, it was good. Hey. You know, we ended on a high note, so that was all really good. Today we have the honor and privilege to have with us new director Dale Fabregar.
Welcome.
And we're going to be talking about sound for picture. And Dale just finished a feature and has some stories about sound and some of the challenges. And we'll visit with Dale on the second half. But Dale, welcome.
Thanks. Good to be here. Thanks.
One interesting fact about Dale is he was actually at our very first podcast.
I was, yeah.
Because he recorded it on video.
Wow.
He was the cameraman.
That's when we had more hair.
I'm just saying, you know, if you want to make it in Hollywood, you got to start at the audio
at the podcast.
I do know that.
Apparently so.
Has anyone seen that? Did you play that for anyone? Or
no, I still have it.
All right,
good. I haven't.
No one has seen it. Probably good.
just for posterity.
Posterity, yeah.
Yeah.
Record it.
But we just kind of want to get into it because a lot's been happening. Scott, were you doing anything interesting while you were gone? I know
yeah.
you were.
Yeah, I've been out recording all sorts of things. I've been spending the last 6 weeks. I recorded a herd of elephants.
Wow.
Lions, went out, recorded a sea night over at Miramar Air Force Base with the Ospreys. I've recorded, it's like every week I'm recording different things. I went in and recorded a computerized robotic system that basically will take a block of aluminum and turn it into an aircraft part.
Wow.
And giant caterpillars, it's been crazy. I've been doing a lot of time recording. I bought a new recorder called a Zaxcom Nomad, which I've been checking out, but I'm not sure. Maybe I might trade it in for a 788. So, but yeah, it's been learning. We've been kind of changing it. We used a lot of contact mics, just doing really out there stuff, a lot of multi-channel and just kind of trying to break the rules a little bit. When we go out and record, we were using 2 788s, Zaxcom 744, and FR2. So we were going out in mass. Depends on what we were doing. We went to Long Beach, and we took giant cargo containers, 80-foot cargo containers, and dropped them on top of each other.
Oh, my goodness.
And, there we had about 30 mics. We were using everything from contacts to D112s to, you know, we used 800Ts. So we had, you know, it just looked like a giant mic fest.
Wow.
And we were, so it's, you know, it's all for an upcoming movie that I'm kind of just finishing the pre-design on.
Right.
So we've
It's a romantic comedy. The first really bad.
I'll tell you, what's interesting with the containers were, there were two of them and they were 80 feet. So when you hit them, the low end wave that would, permeate coming out of them.
Right.
Was crazy. The low end was just beyond comprehension, and so because they became these giant resonators. So for the movies, it's one of the things that I need. So by doing that, it was the most amazing kick drum. And then we took everything, built the 5.1 and multi-channel versions of it back at the studio.
Wow.
And that combined with experimenting with lots of new plugins. And so I feel like I've gone back to school for 6 weeks.
Yeah,
and learned everything. I'm just crash course and everything from Iris to
isn't Iris awesome?
It is awesome.
Oh, I'd love.
I mean, everything we just it's been a lot of times you have technology and you kind of you play with it a little bit and you kind of figure out what you want to do with it, but you don't use it. But now we're trying to learn it. Like, okay, we need it for this. Now we learn it, go through the curves. And you know, and we're I'd say we're only at the beginning of this arc. We're not at the end. So now I've done my first design, beginnings of a design for it. We got to present to the director next week for our conceptual idea. And then, you know, we don't finish until like a little less than a year from now.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's just the beginning.
But at least you'll have some good idea which direction you're going to go. As
oh, yeah.
As-
I mean, being in the middle of a herd of elephants, we had six elephants, oof, was kind of really intimidating. Because they're all moving around and between feet and tusks. And then it's occasionally because what I was fascinated by elephants was that they don't, you know, most people look where their hands are. They, right, their eyes follow their hands. Well, the elephants use their trunks like everyone uses their hands. But they don't necessarily look. So you'll be looking at them and they'll be looking one way and their trunk will be checking you out. So, you know, it'll go on the top of your head and sniff your head and sniff your butt and, you know, and you're sitting there going like, and there's more than one trunk. There's all these trunks and they're, right, they're trying to understand you and you're putting in a microphone and they're like looking at the mic as a giant peanut. So they you know, they want to play with the, they want to play with the fuzzy thing.
Right.
You know, and I got a chance to piss off a lioness.
Wow.
She was showing bare teeth, snarling and, yeah, oh yeah, no, she was, we flew up to Northern California for that.
Wow.
So we've been flying all over the place recording stuff. And
did you sacrifice any microphones for the sake of the elephants?
You know, I hate to say no, but I almost sacrificed a microphone for a robotic system because it moves. And the guy goes, oh, you want me to speed it up? I'm like, yeah, sure. And I was probably like, you know, an inch too close and whack, you know, we're into the Zeppelin. And you're like, oh, sorry about that. You know.
Wow. Now, when you recorded the elephants, what were you actually looking for? The footsteps or just the
no,
sound
vocals.
Of them?
All the vocals. We were trying to get the vocals to not trumpet, but roar. They also do subsonics.
Right.
So the subsonics are pretty pretty trippy.
Right.
So we got all of those. And the roars are hard because they have to be either very excited to do that. So usually we were in a pen with four or five females, and then they brought the male in. And they were all excited to see the mail, so they all started, you know. I think I only got out of 6 hours, I only got two roars.
Wow.
So it was hard. I mean, we also then, we, you know, when we let the elephants kind of relax, so when we went, got some hyenas and some tigers and just whatever they had, we recorded it.
Man, I would have been scared, I'll be honest.
You know, I have to admit, the lioness, I guess somebody had darted her a day or so before and done some teeth work for her. So she didn't really appreciate anyone she didn't know. So when she saw me, the ears went back. She went all the way in the corner and showed me her teeth and snarled.
Oof.
And then I used my microphone fuzzy to make it believe like an animal. So it would look at it like a rabbit, but it would like try to attack the tiger or the lion.
Was she in a chain or a cage?
No, she was in, you know, it's funny, they're all in cages. But the reality is they're there because they want to be, because if they didn't want, they can get out.
Wow.
So, yeah, she was. I was definitely had a healthy, you know, but I was, what, about 4 feet?
Wow.
5 feet? Which wasn't that far.
It's crazy.
But you know, you got to get, and a boom pole. And the ability with good sneakers to run.
Yeah. Was that 96 or 192?
We were going back. It depends on what it was, but we were back and forth between 96 and 192.
Wow.
You know, we did a lot of stuff in 192, and I'm not sure I believe in it. Because when you get into Pro Tools and you start wanting to use your plugins,
right,
not everything works well, and it's pretty unstable. And I found 96 is fine.
Cool. Wow. Well, that beats me. I went to the mall.
Did you record it?
That was probably better than the first thing.
Diego, you've been working on something really interesting.
Yes.
And now we can talk about it.
Yeah.
I know it's been under wraps for a while, but why don't you tell everybody what you have done?
Well, I disappeared a little bit from the podcast because I was scoring Chernobyl Diaries. The new film produced by Oren Peli, you know, the creators of Paranormal Activity.
Yes.
That was a trip.
And it looks scary. I mean, it looks just fear written all over it.
I'm going to go see it. I mean, I can't say too much about the film, but what I've done, it's
intense.
Now let's talk about what you've done. How did you approach the score for this? I mean, you obviously have your own musical style and your own things. What did they want from you when they came to ask you to score the feature?
Well, the director wrote me that he liked what I was doing, you know, with my instruments and stuff like that. And so basically, he liked the idea of me using unconventional instruments and things like that. So I played the whole score. I really had fun composing it and playing it at the same time. And I combined the custom-built instruments with some new techniques on traditional instruments, and then these massive plugins, chains, all customized and stuff like that. It's been a very, very great experience. Very, you know, intense in terms of how much work you got to put into it, but very rewarding for me.
Now, when you actually scored it, did you, because I know you work on Pro Tools, but Pro Tools is kind of like, you play Pro Tools.
Yeah.
It's kind of like an instrument. Yeah. Is were you doing the same techniques that you do for all your other things?
Yeah.
With the multi-layering and things like that?
Yeah.
Or did you go a little more conventional with the sequencer?
No, actually, I didn't use any MIDI at all. I was just playing everything. And if I used a synthesizer here and there to generate a certain sound, I was just playing it, and then I was processing the sound later, as I like to do. I mean, I like... That's the part I really love. It's creating the sounds. And in this case, I had an opportunity to actually create the music and everything for the film. So I just kept my process there and expanded it. So
now, when you actually delivered the files for the stage, where did you stem your parts out 5-1? Break it up like percussion and break it up?
Yeah, that's the common way of breaking down the score.
Right.
And obviously, you know, each track is different. Each cue has more or less elements, so it just exports stuff that makes sense to be exported that way, and that's how it works.
You know, I really want to hear it because I want to see the movie. Because you know, usually score in a movie—that's where you get your emotion from. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's where you get the—you know—it's the movie telling you how to feel, for lack of a better definition. And I know how your music is, so. Man, the movie's telling you to fear for your life.
Well, there are parts that are, you know, very abstract and very sound design oriented, but there are also parts that are melodic, because I wanted to bring a little bit of both into the score. I didn't want it to make it just like a drone, you know, like a set of drones that, even though they work very well because they don't really demand too much attention from the viewer, but they actually do what the director and the producers want. You know, when you create an element that it's there, it gives you the sense of, you know, being scared or there's something happening, and it doesn't have to be too complex.
Right.
If it's done right, it just works.
Now, did you, like, obviously when you saw the temp cut, did it have temp music in there that the director kind of said, you know, hey, we kind of want something along this feel? And did you live with it for a couple of days, or how did you approach that?
I mean, well, actually, the stuff in the temp score sounded kind of in my world already.
Okay.
The kind of approach, the kind of musical approach there was similar to the kind of things I do. But the film wasn't fully temped. So there were parts where the temp score was there and other parts where I just had, you know, an opportunity to say, here's what I think could work here. And then, you know, we discussed, obviously, it's a process that you go through and the score evolves and to the point where everybody's happy and, and it works.
How long were you on the project?
I think it was about... 8 weeks, something like that.
Wow.
Yeah, that was fast.
That was.
And where did you guys mix the film?
It was down in Culver City at Sonic Magic.
Great.
It was nice, you know.
Now, were you ever scared working on it?
Well, when I first saw the film, I looked around the house and say, am I alone or... Yeah, obviously now I watched it so many times, the first time it got me, so that was good. That's why when I watched the film, I noticed two things. First of all, that I got into the story, and the other thing that I noticed is that the images were just beautiful. I just love the Brett Parker as the director. Mm-hmm. I just love the way he was looking at the scenes. And it's funny because the first thing he showed me was a scene, and I described him the feeling that I had about this scene. And he said, well, this is exactly what I was trying to say with this scene. So I thought, well, that's good. You know, looks like I'm getting it. And so it was very nice.
Wow. Yeah. Now, let me ask you, and Rob, you can answer too, because you've worked on a score. When you get a job like that, do you ever like just go into like full on panic mode after you say yes? You're thinking, oh my goodness, I got to come up with.
I do. I think it's healthy. I think it's healthy. I mean, not for very long.
Right.
But yeah, because once you actually realize I'm doing this,
right.
That's a huge responsibility.
Because yeah, that's a lot of music. That's a lot of sound.
But you know, when you do scores, you have the. This list of cues and everything, you just start breaking down things in bits. You don't really approach the full thing as
one big thing. That would be overwhelming.
You don't even think in terms of how many minutes or anything you have to do. You just look, okay, I'm starting here, or you start whatever you feel comfortable in terms of, because you have the whole thing, you know.
Right.
And then you just move to the next cue, and then you start delivering, and then maybe there's a note, and then you just, it's a process that, but I see what you mean. To me, I think I didn't really have the time to go into panic mode. It was just, I got to do it, that's it.
Yeah.
But I was under pressure. I felt I was really...
Yeah, that's an intense schedule, 8 weeks.
Yeah. But it worked. I mean...
pressure can be a good thing.
Yeah.
Nothing wrong with that.
Oh, you have to have it.
Yeah.
It just kind of gets you focused.
Mm-hmm. No, but you know, the cool thing about working on a score to me is that you have a chance to... talk with other people, for example, the director and the producer. They have a certain vision for the music that is something that can help you get to direction that you wouldn't go by yourself. So you still retain your approach, which is mine, is obviously playing with custom-built instruments and stuff. But then the kind of input they give you, they make you think, and you realize that that kind of input helps you create something different, something better.
You're lucky when you have a creative team that gives you that kind of input. That's actually really good.
Well, in this case, it was because the communication between us was very easy. They were able to articulate. You know, there's always this thing that directors are very visual and musicians they talk in terms of music. But the kind of dialogue that we had was very clear. And so I was able to understand exactly what was their vision for the music and in terms of frequencies and things like that. So,
were there any parts of the film that just gave you a hard time where you're thinking, holy crap, how am I going to get through this?
No, there are parts of the film, like I think every film, that can be heard in different ways.
Right.
So you start with one version. And then maybe the director or the producer, they think, what if you try something else? Or what if you don't try rhythms and you try something that is more sparse and things like that? And so you try, and then once you've done this thing, you realize, you know, actually that was a good idea because you came up with something different. So I think it's more, as I said, a matter of that you can see the same scene in different ways. You can hear the scene differently.
Did you ever make any big changes? Did you ever go one direction on any particular part and said, turn around and try something else?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. There were a couple of cues that were totally different because the approach was more rhythmic at the beginning, and then they ended up being more, scored moment by moment where you're actually telling what's happening in the scene rather than having a piece of music that starts and evolves and keep going until the scene is done. Mm-hmm. But I like that because, you know, the first of all, obviously I was under pressure. There's a lot of work and everything, but I was having fun. I mean, I had bruises on my arm because I was playing stuff so hard.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, I had a dulcimer, a zither that I was holding with my left arm, and then I was banging it with a drumstick. But I wanted to create this sound of snapping strings and stuff, so the strings were bouncing on my arm. So when I went to see them with the cue, I said, guys, I just want to show you. So Oren told me, well, you're really, really, really giving everything for this course. I said, well, I don't have half measures, you know. I'm going to kill myself, but I'm going to make it sound great.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
That's awesome. All right, finally, last thing. So without giving anything away, mm-hmm. are there any like favorite parts that the stuff that you'd like? Yeah, the middle's really great, or the end's really cool, or I like the beginning cues. I mean,
well, I actually have several parts that I like, because as I said, there were parts that are very sound design, so you have a chance to really explore that kind of weird, abstract way of creating a cue. And there are parts where it's more melodic, so you have a chance to play, and I actually play bass and guitar, but there were, you know, pieces of metal going through and stuff like that.
I was
going
to say, you play bass and guitar, but you play them with each other.
Exactly.
use the guitar as a capo on the bass.
Yeah. No, I built this plug-in chains that basically I could just move the guitar like this on the table. It was making this beautiful sound. So I was playing just few notes, but those notes were like moving and growing and going to.
That's awesome. I'm looking forward to seeing it, actually. I really am. And I don't like those kind of movies. So
well,
when I can't sleep that night, can I call you?
Yes.
Diego, I just saw your film.
It's your fault. No.
What are you doing now?
Right.
That's awesome. Yeah. I mean, that's really great. I'm really looking forward to it. And I like the trailer. The trailer looks really cool. Mm-hmm. So
yeah.
It looks scary, though. It looks really, really scary.
It's intense.
Yeah. So, well, good. Wow. That's a lot of pressure. That is a lot of pressure.
Yeah.
Speaking of pressure, I have a story that I'm going to tell you guys that happened to me this weekend. I'm doing these commercials, and I had to have 4 commercials done by today, mm-hmm. which is Monday. And I didn't finish it on Friday, and I had to do some sound design. So I took it home, the sound design home, and I have my little drive and my little MacBook, and I went and I did some sound design, and it was really cool. I was really getting into it and everything, and that's all awesome. It's really good. And I finished the first one. I copied it and did some more, and I had to do a little premix and then saved it, the whole thing. Today shows up. I forgot the drive at home.
Ouch! Not nice.
Talk about pressure.
Yep. You got all the way in and discovered that?
Yes, and I don't live close.
I know.
So, just so happens. Just so happens that the first 3 I actually saved on the laptop, and the laptop was with me. So I actually, because I said, you know, I should create a copy and just kind of have this moved on. The last 2, I have never worked so fast in all my life. I already knew what I had done.
Right.
So it's not like I had to recreate the wheel or anything.
But it was still faster than going home.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, not only that, but then it's like sitting with the creatives who wanted to do approvals. And I was, have you ever been under so much pressure that you like you feel like you're going to throw up? I mean, that's where I was. On top of having coffee, because I had stayed up till 4 o'clock in the morning, and I was like, I was so wired. So I'm like, cut this, and I just, you know, this is where you like throw a compressor on it, and you don't care how loud it is, because you're just gonna set the threshold. And this is, you know, hey, this is just a temp mix, guys. You know,
you're just gonna
say that a lot, and so I'm cutting the whole thing, and finally the guy comes in. And they listened to the first 3 and they liked it. And so they're listening to the next one. And the creative's sitting back there, and he goes, wow, this one's going to need a lot of work. But we're not going to show it today anyhow. So I'm like, woo! But that was like, man.
Remember the drive.
I know. Tonight. I know. Yeah.
Oh,
I
just
know.
Move closer.
I know.
Put it all on the cloud.
No, you don't know. That is so not like me to forget a drive like that. I mean, I've never had that happen.
Because you're carrying around 3-4 devices.
Yeah, I know. I know. That's why I do it. But just goes to show you, you know, you can never have too many backups, even if you only have to back up. But yeah, that was crazy. You ever had anything like that happen to Rob? Crazy pressure. I mean, crazy
pressure? I think it's a really long time ago. I think we once flew out to start a tour with Stevie and forgot a drive back in L.A. I seem to remember that happening. I think it was a Synclavier drive. We're talking a long time ago.
Right.
That's, I mean, normally I work at my own place, so I don't usually forget a drive because they're all right there.
Right.
I do remember starting a tour, though. It was actually without one of the computers. We got to the road. We had forgotten we had taken the computer out of its road case.
Right.
So we're setting up in London or something and open the case and there's no computer. And there's no feeling like that sinking feeling in your stomach as you open the road case and realize it's empty. And you're very far from home.
Yes. Oh,
I can only imagine.
I do remember that vividly. And I hadn't even been with him that long. That was like in 87, 88. That's a long time ago.
Like a oops.
Yeah, that was a major oops.
Wow. Yeah,
I'm getting a little sick just thinking about it. nothing recently like
that. Hey, I will tell you that, you know, as bad as that is when you're in the moment, I can't tell you the relief when you make it through. Like, once I knew that I was going to be okay and not die today,
I was like,
oh, I love everybody.
Yeah. Well, you know, when, anytime you start a project, it's like looking at a vertical wall. Yeah. Or it may be even sometimes inverted. And you go, how am I going to do this? And then once you get to the point, you're going, hey, I got a little momentum, and I think it's starting to happen.
And then you go out for lunch.
Yeah. Hey, have you ever been in a position, Scott, where you're like, you just ultimate, like, just make you sick pressure like that? I mean,
you know what? I think I'm right now. No, I think every project I do, to be honest, that has its own set of challenges,
right,
whether it's political, you know, you work with people that have interesting personalities, or even the project I'm on now is probably the biggest project I've ever worked on. So when I first started it, every day I just saw this vertical wall going, I don't even know where to start.
And the next day there was a lion.
So, you know, you sit there and you go, I think I need this. You know, and then, you know, you go and record stuff, or even the conception, how am I going to crew it?
Right.
How do I start? How do I dig into this? And I've been on it now for 8 weeks, and I only feel that I've gotten a hold in the last week.
Wow.
So it's been 7 weeks of massive insecurity.
I'm sorry, I don't even mean to interrupt, but I just remembered my worst nightmare horror story.
Oh, we got it so bad
that I had actually blacked it out. And I'll never forget it. It was when I had done the trailer for the second Godzilla trailer. And it was the one where the old man is on a fishing pier,
right,
and then Godzilla comes and destroys the pier. It's a pretty well-known trailer from a long time ago. But we were going to record the orchestra at Tadeo in Studio City. I'll never forget this. And back then we would record on D88s. I'd have six of them, so we'd have 48 tracks. And you'd have to stripe them with time code and have them ready to go so that when you got to the studio, because the studio time is really expensive, you want to just pop in the tapes. They had six decks there. Pop in the tapes, boom, record 48 tracks. So I had striped all the tapes to record the orchestra for. And it was a 100-piece symphony orchestra. It was a big group. So I get to Tadeo. I'm all excited and nervous. This is actually only the second trailer I had done with a giant symphony at that point. So I'm trying not to make any mistakes or anything else. I get to the studio. The orchestra's getting in their seats. The engineer asked me for the blank tapes that I had striped, and I had left them at home. And I lived near Universal Studios. So I lived 10 or 15 minutes from there. But the room was filling up. I mean, probably 80 to 90 of the players were already seated. The percussion was already in, you know, giant cartage and trucks dropping all. We had giant taiko drums and, you know, timpanis and all this crazy percussion. Everything set up. And I'm realizing there's no one at my house. Without those tapes, we're not recording anything. All the mucky mucks from Sony Pictures have already gotten there. They're in the back of the room, you know, drinking coffee and high-fiving each other at how cool this is. And I don't have anything to record them on. I got in my car. And I broke so many laws. I think I got home and back to Tadeo in about 12 seconds.
Wow.
No, I mean, literally, I probably got home in 7 or 8 minutes and got back in 7 or 8 minutes.
Wow.
It was insane. I remember, like, pegging 90 on the freeway, and I was only going, like, one exit. But I ran into the house. I was so freaked out that I discovered later when I went home, I had left the front door open.
Wow.
I basically busted into the house. If my key had been too slow, I would have kicked down the door. I busted into the house. I grabbed the tapes, which were sitting right on the kitchen counter, and I left. I didn't even close the door.
Oh my goodness. I was that
freaked out.
Oh, man.
I got back to the studio, though. I mean, everybody had started to wonder, why aren't we starting yet? Because we only had the budget to record for 1 hour. When you have an orchestra that big,
right?
I mean, the union rates for something that big, it's like $25,000 an hour just to have them sitting in the room. So, and that's not the engineers or anything else. That's just the union orchestra. So you don't waste a lot of time. And once we got to the point where we were like 10 or 15 minutes and we hadn't started yet, everybody started to look around. And I tried to walk in casually like, oh, yeah, I was just getting a glass of water. I'm back. Everything's cool. Oh, you guys ready for me? And just nonchalantly handed the guy the tapes. I remember when that session was over, I slumped over in my chair. I could not believe how stupid I felt and that I had survived it.
I can believe.
That moment, you can relate?
I can believe how.
I mean, that moment where I realized I didn't have the tapes and they were in my house and it was locked and there was no one there.
Wow.
Yeah. I will never forget that. And that's 15 years ago already.
Wow.
Okay, so I had blacked that out. That was the most intense.
Hey, Dale.
Yeah.
You're not going to escape this.
Oh, no.
Come on. Alternate, just pressure, just make you.
I don't know. I'm always under pressure. But it's like, you guys are talking about 8-week production, and that's a lot of stress. I do movies in 5 to 6 days.
Wow.
So that is, it shows you what kind of movies those are. But that's a lot of stress there.
Oh, yeah.
And
doing, nothing can go wrong. Right?
Yeah, exactly. And it's, I never get enough time to do what I need to do. The DP gets his time, everyone gets their makeup wardrobe, and then it's like, oh, you got 5 minutes, and then we're going to pull the plug. I mean, it doesn't seem fair, but those are the challenges. But I think, I'm trying to think, there was one time, and it was
but
my
you
mistake.
Find it exhilarating at the same time, because you're moving so quick.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you have no choice. Like you said, once it's over, you think, how did we do that? You know, but it's not really, I mean, it's just, you know, you don't want to do things like that as much as possible, but sometimes you just have to do it. And when you pull through, it is a great feeling. You know, everyone high fives and you hug and you think, oh, if I just had one more take, 3 more minutes or something, you know. But yeah, I mean, but I'm trying to think of a time I was doing a music video in Morocco and I had all my shot lists and everything notes on my laptop. And I remember we set it up and we were in this big club. And I had my backpack, my laptop, and everyone was cool there. And I don't know what happened. I turned around and we were about to go and I had everything figured out in my head, but you need this kind of reference material and people are asking you, where's this and that? And so I turn and my laptop is gone. I'm thinking, who jacked it? I mean, who took it? I mean, and we had like 200 kids, extras. None of them can speak English. We always had to go through a translator. Yeah. And there's all my American stuff there. And I'm thinking, someone jacked my computer. And I didn't tell anybody, my partner. I was like, I was sweating and we were about to go and I'm thinking, my computer, it's gone. Oh my God. Oh my God. It's gone. He's like, what, where was it? And he and I are just quietly trying to be calm, looking all over for this thing, and ended up, I guess one of their assistants had just kindly moved it over in a safer area. And I was like, so relieved. But that was probably when I thought I had lost, I mean, everything, contacts, everything, right, for like 20 minutes. I freaked out.
Is the worst.
But that was a hairy shoot, because I remember you telling me the story when you shot on the streets, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, they're doing a music video and it was supposed to be, you know, a couple thousand and end up being.
Yeah. Well, I guess we had permits to be out in the square, which I think they've only filmed once before years ago. And so, we, you know, things just go out of control. Can go out of control very quickly there. And people are very cool and they're cheering you on, but that can immediately turn into vegetables and rocks and stones and things if they're unhappy for whatever reason. So it was really, there's a music video out. It was for the country of Morocco, you know, and Red One. He was a producer and he did something for the country. It was really nice. And it was a one big shoot where we had thousands of people. It started off with hundreds, which is a lot for me. And again, it was through a first AD who handled everything, and he was fantastic, a deal. And we just didn't have enough people to manage it. It was so wild, you know, but we had the stage and everyone went out there. And once the sun went down, I remember my partner was saying, I think we need extras. And we said, these people are just waiting for an excuse to come and attend something. And as soon as we had some lights and cameras, the crane was up and thousands of people were there immediately, and it was pretty hairy. And I remember sitting in the back thinking, oh my goodness, I hope nothing goes wrong. And people are trying to jump on the stage and perform, and we let them, like, have fun, you know, we're not ready to go yet, and people just waiting for something to happen, you know. It was pretty hairy.
Well, hey, we're gonna take a break, mainly so that everybody can just recover from all these bad feelings. Rob is like totally ashen white right now.
One of the ones Rob and I shared together.
But which one?
Remember the phone call one that I called you? And
oh,
yeah. Rob could tell that story from my perspective.
All right, well, I'll tell you what. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll lead with that story before we get into talking with Dale. All right, so we'll see you on the other side.
listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by API and Westwave Audio. Have a question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the LA area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com.
Hey, welcome back to the Audio Nowcast. And before the break, we were telling stories of horror.
Yes. And we're not done.
And we're not done, actually. Scott, you had a really good one you wanted to share?
Yeah, you know, this, it's an older one, but but Rob...
It's an oldie, but a goodie.
It's an oldie, but a goodie. I did a movie a while back called True Lies with James Cameron. And we had technology at the time called Waveframe. Now, at the time when they dubbed movies... on MAG, they can go backwards and forwards when they mix, so they can do EQing. So they can EQ backwards and then hit forwards, and there was no instant access, so you had to deal with tape. So it just happened that any time it went backwards, it would put out reverse time code. Now, the Waveframe 1000 at the time didn't appreciate backwards time code, and it would crash. So when it crashed, it would take about, it felt like an hour, probably to about 12 minutes to boot.
It Ours was 14. It was in that range.
Yeah. So, you know, he would play a sound and he'd go, "Oh, I like it. Can we do something? Like, can you just pitch it down?" I go, "Here you go." And the mixer would hit backwards play and it would lock up. And he'd one hit play again. And I go, "I need to reboot the machine." And 12 minutes later, he'd hear one sound and he would back up. And so, Jim, who, you know, is a very patient man. kind of looked at me like, with a language, not appreciating the situation, and Jim again can be very vocal at times when he's not happy, especially about things that don't seem to make sense for him. So, upon the several times of this happening, you know, we tried many things to install. The time code, some kind of filter, like relays and anything like that to make it where my system wouldn't get reverse time code. So at that point, I was out of ideas. Engineering was out of ideas. And I panically called Rob.
But you know what? And I will pick
it
up
here.
And
I'm saying it really nicely at this point.
Well, have you ever had someone call you? Well, have you ever had someone call you who was a hostage? Because that's what he sounded like. Like, he sounded so... overcome. It's like, Rob, this is Scott. I need your help with something. I mean, he sounded so bizarre and so freaked out, but he had that sort of that freaked out calm thing, and I could tell something was wrong because he never sounds like that. And you calmly asked, "What do you use to avoid sending backwards time code to the Waveframe?" And I think I recommended the fast forward reshaper thing,
fast forward,
which is really good.
Yeah.
And that's what we used to use because our Waveframe, it would run for about 10 minutes and then crash and then take 14 minutes to boot. So it was a nightmare. But I've never heard him sound that freaked out before. And I mean, you were quivering for weeks after that project.
Oh, yeah. I mean, but it wasn't a, okay, thank you. It was, how do I get it? How fast can I get it? And can I get it now?
Right. And I don't mean now like, sometime today. I mean, like, I need to blink and it's here.
what was the solution?
The solution was fast
it's a MIDI
forward.
Time code, yeah.
It was fast forward made this box that was a time code reshaper that would only reshape the time code when it was running forward. So
I
it was
you.
Reading it. It knew if it was good code and then it would reshape it. But if it wasn't good code, it wouldn't reshape it. And there were probably other boxes that did that too.
And it was probably one of the more up there with the most stressful moments.
Oh, that's the most freaked out I've ever heard you sound.
Yeah.
I mean.
Because you got to be calm. You're in a dubbing stage. Next to me is James Cameron, mm-hmm. who's not happy. And a not happy.
No, I mean, Scott's being nice. He was screaming. I mean, he was just like in a purple fog screaming at Scott like. And you'd have had to beep like 90% of the words. I mean, it was just torture.
That reminds me of something. When you're in a situation like that of just ultimate horror, just ultimate pressure, the people that you're working with are one of two. They're either super, super vocal and angry and screaming, or the other one, which is almost worse, is when there's no emotion. There's just stoic, just silence, just nothing.
Well, usually when they're like that, it's because they figured out who they're going to hire when they get rid of your silly ass. Basically.
I gotta add to this horror story carnival. I was working with Teddy Riley. I was over in Future Recording Studios. I had convinced him to chuck his whole Atari ST MIDI live setup that they had and to go with a Mac setup. So we went with Mac 2 CIs at the time. I mean, they were this a while ago. And he spent like, you know, $40,000, did all this new stuff, re-racked everything, the whole thing. He comes in for the playback of the sequences, which, by the way, I had to convert from Atari real time. The only way to get all the information, I couldn't use a standard MIDI file because there was too much. I had to literally come out of the out and into the in and record it and use what's called a MIDI data filter so that I could turn off like aftertouch and stuff that would just overload it. Anyhow, to make a long story short, I did all that, converted all these songs. He comes in, I hit play. It's all wrong. I mean, man. It's all wrong. And we're literally in like 2 days leaving for a production rehearsal over in Maryland. And he was just, it was quiet. He didn't say anything. He was just like.
It was holding an axe though.
That's not right. Then he leaves and I'm like, oh my goodness, I'm going home. And comes his engineer, Jean-Marie, comes up to me and says, yo, Teddy says you need to get your boop together. That was it. I was up for 2 days straight, and I was like comparing the MIDI screen on the Atari ST with the Mac screen and looking for any note that just wasn't right. And I was like, that was sheer panic. But it was that just he was calm. He didn't say a word. He was not angry. He just left and had his hitman come in.
Well, I have one last Stevie Hire one, which you guys will like. I think this is before you worked with us, maybe, but we were in Berlin. Did you ever do Berlin with us?
No.
Okay, so this is before that. So we're doing a show in Berlin, and the weather was supposed to be, we thought, nice. And then we heard stories that it might rain, and everybody said, no, all the weather forecast said it was going to be nice. So we end up going out. It's an outdoor gig at like an amphitheater. I think it's a very famous old amphitheater in Berlin. And we're doing the show, and we see storm clouds coming over. And it starts to rain during the show. And then the race is on to see, are we going to get the show done, or are they going to have to call it because of rain? And it starts raining, and it's raining harder, and it's raining harder. And Stevie's out on stage. I'll never forget this. He's sitting on stage, and we have a grand piano out there, and his harmonica is on there. And he's trying to find the harmonica for, you know, Isn't She Lovely or something. And he's reaching around, and I can see his hands splashing in puddles on the grand piano. And this isn't the worst of it. But so the grand piano is filling up with water. He's a good sport. I mean, he doesn't care. So he's splashing around on the piano, and you can reach in and feel water in the piano. Plays harmonica, everything else. But what I notice is the wind has shifted, and the wind is driving the rain onto the stage, and it's becoming like a really intense storm. I mean, people are starting to, like, you know, leave, and it's scary. I mean, there wasn't lightning, but it's really pouring rain. And I look over, and the synclavier, I realize, is sitting in the middle of the stage. This is, for people who don't know, it's about a $400,000 computer instrument system, and we used to carry it on the road for a lot of the sequencer stuff before, you know, personal computers could do this stuff. But the water is spilling into the synclavier, and I'm thinking, oh my God, this is going to do some damage that we're not going to be able to deal with. And I thought, please, let's just make it to the end of the show. And I remember the last song on the show was Skeletons in Your Closet, and the song ended, and the water is pouring into the synclavier. And we made it to the end of the song, like the last dun hit, and the crowd goes nuts and everything, and the synclavier exploded.
Oh, my God.
And everybody thought it was pyrotechnics.
Right.
It was not. And that was the last light of day that synclavier saw for a year and a half. We had to ship it back to Vermont. It had completely exploded.
Wow.
Every power supply, every circuit card, I mean, everything in it was dead.
Wow.
And we actually had a spare. Back then we were smart. We actually had a second one with us, and we had to limp along with just that one. But it was completely destroyed, and the audience thought it was part of the show. And I told Stevie, you know, that got a great reaction, but that's a really expensive way to end the show every night.
Let's see, if we blew up a synclavier every show.
Yeah. There are much cheaper things that will make a bigger flame.
Man, you know what? We could tell these stories all night
and
long.
You know what? If you survive in the industry long enough, you will have these stories too. Right.
So that was actually kind of cool. And in honor of the horror film that Diego scored, we came up with horror stories of our own.
Some real life horrors.
Someone should do a movie about musicians' horror stories.
That would really be scary.
But you kind of need it. I mean, to get seasoned. So then when stuff does happen, I mean, you know, in every project, you were talking even with yourself, you have to think on your feet.
Yeah.
The more you do it, you kind of want all of these little problems to kind of hit you early on.
Oh, yeah.
So then what it does is it gives you a lot of confidence. And, I mean, as a sound supervisor in charge of the sound for a movie, there always seems to be some crisis that's always happening. And you just deal with it. And sometimes you don't even think about it when it's happening. You're like, okay, you assess the situation. You've been for it. You've already felt the pain before.
Right.
So it's not like new pain. Yeah. So you just kind of go, okay, here we go.
It's all about experience. You can't learn that stuff. Yeah. They won't teach it in school. I mean, they can.
Yeah, you got to go through it. What's actually kind of fun is when you've been through it so much that you're going through another crisis and you're with somebody who hasn't been through a crisis and you slowly watch them melt down and you're over, or not. You're like, you know, don't worry about it. It's not going to kill you. We'll get through this, you know. Well, why? Because this and that. We don't have the old
It's just a project.
And
it will pass.
And Prilosec and Malax.
Yes.
But having said all that, I would prefer never to have another one now.
No. Once you've had them, you don't want more.
But it's what you say is so true, Scott, is it's trial by fire, you know. This is where you get sharpened and honed, and this is where you really get your chops, you know, when you go through those problems. As a matter of fact, I'm definitely a better mixer, you know, sound designer for having toured than if I didn't, because of all the challenges that I – you know, came across touring, and it was, you just learn how to think on your feet and you have ultimate responsibility, which I always tell people. I said, the thing about being on the road and actually even working in audio is it's one of the few jobs where the buck stops with you. The right. buck stops here. Like Diego, when you were scoring, if anything was wrong with the score, it was on your shoulders, you know, and there's not a lot of jobs that are like that. There's, you know, a lot of jobs where you can kind of pass the buck. And the thing about working in our industry is the buck stops with us.
Well, definitely. Yeah. I mean, you can't say someone stole my inspiration last night.
Exactly. Someone stole.
Yeah.
That's actually a pretty good line.
I know.
Yeah.
Having said that, I want to segue into talking and visiting with Dale, because we were, you know, everything we're talking about is sound, and we're kind of talking a little bit about sound for picture. And I wanted to bring Dale on because Dale shoots a lot of movies and he does it fast. But one of the interesting things is Dale's philosophy with sound and everything. And Dale, why don't you just tell us a little bit about your shoot?
Well, the last one I did is an indie, and it did take longer than 5 days, which was nice. and like we were just saying, it makes you stronger and better. So this one, I don't know what's worse, having a lot more money and shorter days, or less money and longer days. And so that's kind of what I was facing. We had the smallest budget ever, but I had a full 22-day schedule, which was really, really tough. But it was a drama, and it was really nice, and it was a really special film. Mm-hmm. So it was really great working on it. But in this instance, you know, the producers, we had very little money. We knew we wanted to shoot it great. All that stuff is given. But, you know, we were all on the same page and agreed that one of the most important aspects of it was the sound. You know, I mean, it's kind of obvious, but, you know, even my cinematographer, Patrick Jones, I knew he was the right guy when we were talking, and, you know, picture and images is really important, but he couldn't agree more. He says, it's even more important than what I do, guys. We need good sound guys there. And you guys are all at this level. We're just trying to get really good sound recorded on the day and as clean and as professional as we can. So with our tiny budget, we had a lot of people volunteering, a lot of students. It was tough, you know, a lot of green. But one place the producers did not skimp on was the audio side. So and it was kind of sketchy at first. We had a couple of people that were in, and one person had to go out, and then we didn't know who we were going to hire. And they said, well, do you know anyone, Dale? And I made a couple of calls and got some solid people to work out, and they turned out to be fantastic. And yeah, it's so important for us to get good sound. I think, you know, we're in post now, so we haven't gotten into sound yet, but they were really, really happy. I saw some, you know, dailies, and they already synced all the footage with the audio, everything, and it sounded pretty darn good. So we were happy. But, you know, we got a lot of other challenges up ahead to clean it all up and everything. But yeah, it was really important for us to get sound, and they recognized that, even the DP, which was really, really cool.
So you're running like wireless mics and
yeah, both.
And how many, like 8 channels recording?
It was only 4. I mean, there was probably only about, there was a time when there was like 5 or 6 characters in a room, but it was in one room. But, you know, they were running, you know, we were at a park and they were like long distance. So we shot that. So those were wireless, and but it was a good job. It was only about a 4-channel mixer they had. But I think that for me though, I mean, I'd done a lot of smaller movies, and what they did for this one was, and it was all, you know, this is kind of, I guess it's obvious too, but it was all time code. For me, it was the first time to work that way with the camera. I mean, it was always slated for all the previous things, but it was always hand and visually synced in post with an editor, audio assistant. But this one, they didn't want to go that way. They wanted all time code, all synced, everything in camera. And so it was my first time to do it that way. And it was really kind of cool to have them do that. And I didn't know anything about that. And these other guys, you know, the new guys that came in did. Our first sound guy didn't want to go that way. And that was kind of the problem. He said, we've been doing, you know, sound without any time code for years, you know, so why do we need to do that? And I was thinking, I didn't say anything. And the producer's like, okay, thank you very much. They hung up and they got some other guys to do it. And I don't think it was really more about equipment. It was more about sort of attitude and kind of embracing. I mean,
absolutely.
And the reason why it was brought up was because Post said, hey, if you do it this way, you can save this much time.
Well, by doing auto conforms and stuff.
Yeah. And so it'll go a lot faster. It'll be smoother, quicker. You'll get to do it. So we said, okay, let's do it that way. And, you know, that's how they did it. So.
And so you were pleased with your sound guys?
Very, 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 very.
So was it just a mixer and then a boom operator?
I mean, yeah, it was actually, you know, it's low budget. So it was the one guy who did it all, and then he got really tired.
Right.
And so we ended up getting another guy, and then he kind of came in and working it and trained them. So it's, you know, it was pretty tough.
Tell us, just walk us through, like, because there's, you know, we get a lot of listeners, a lot of students that want to be, you know, working film and want to be audio mixers and things like that. Tell us what a typical day would be on one of your shoots, because this is actually a place where a lot of people could get started with features that are, you know, independents and short schedules and things like that.
Well, you know, one thing that I've learned is I always have their call time the latest, because that sound guys are always ready. I mean, they plug in, they wire things up, and they're ready to go. So, you know, camera, lighting, all those guys are there way in advance. Art is always there first, you know, poor guys. But yeah, I mean, what's a typical day like?
I mean, just any day.
I just trust these. That's why you just want good, solid people with you, because I don't really think about it that much. I mean, there's one company that I use all the time, Action Audio, and I got a good friend over there who I've worked with for years, and he hooks us up with all the gear and gets good people. I've always used like 2 or 3 of the same guys every time from everything I've done, and hopefully they get a little better and a little bigger budget, and they come on, but they love working, you know, on these little projects. But, you know, I mean, I the only thing I recognize is their friendly attitude and that they don't have problems. I mean, those are the guys that I like to use. I've been on other shoots where we've had problems, but it goes pretty smoothly. I just try to not to even worry about it, and it isn't even.
So, like a daytime shoot, what time do they go? 6 a.m., 7?
Yeah, okay, let's just say 6.
6?
6 a.m.
And how long are you shooting for?
I try to do everything in about 10 hours.
10 hours? Yeah. So they're for like 6 to 4, 6 yeah. to 6, yeah. somewhere
yeah.
around there?
Yeah.
Well, that's not too bad. And then your night shoots are?
They're like 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. It's kind of brutal. Yeah. Or even 5 to 5 because the sun will come up, right? So, yeah, it can get very tiring. And, you know, we don't have the comforts of, in this last one, we didn't have the comforts of like, any trailers, or I worked on other projects where at least there's a trailer and a decent catering, and there's some of those comforts a little bit, but this one was so lean, you know, and so it was probably one of the hardest ones that I'd worked on, but it was, you know, sometimes those are the most special ones that can look back versus it was totally horror. Yeah. And it was not that situation. It was really, we hope it all comes together I'm really excited about it. It's called Lonely Boy.
Now, most of the mixers that you work with on set, do they bring their own gear and you,
yes.
you work a deal for them and their gear?
That's right. I used to get separate sound guys and then they would bring their cart or they would, you know, they have their own package or whatever. But I would go to this one company and he would hook us up with everything. So we would pay them one, whatever the deal is, the producers work out, and that would include the guy's time and all his gear, whatever it is, you know. And they always throw in some extra stuff for me. So, yeah.
That's cool. So what kind of advice would you give to someone who wants to get started and who wants to work on a couple of your shoots? Because it seems like, you know, you're bigger and bigger projects.
Call me.
Like that.
Because we're always looking for Yeah. No, I mean, yeah. I mean, it's just, again, you know, you just do it. You just try to do what you want, what you can do. And, you know, you can't worry about it, you know. And I think we were talking about things and walls and you get nervous. And, yeah, I mean, every time I get faced with a new project, I always wonder, you know, how's that all going to happen? And it's funny, the buck stops in your department. But when you're a director, I mean, the target is on you no matter what. I mean, I didn't have enough time. It doesn't matter. At the end of the day, if they liked it or they didn't like it, your name is on it. So it's like that really is, it's really tough. I mean, I worked on a few movies and I did it because it was a good experience and it was an experimental project.
Right.
And even in the found footage area. So I know Oren's work very well. And I did one which the producers were thrilled with. You know, it sold, went to IFC. It's fantastic. But I didn't expect as many people to really see it. But, you know, it's all good. You know, but people look at it and you just think, wow, you know, you just don't have enough time sometimes. But it made me a lot better the next time I had more than, you know, 5 minutes. Seriously, you know, it just, it's a lot better, you know.
That's cool.
So, yeah, just do it. Just do it. Not to sound too cliche, but.
No, but that's.
But it's true, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, like, what would you say would be the most, probably the worst thing somebody walking onto your set could do to, like, you not to call them back?
Oh boy, that's a good question. There's so many things that could go wrong. That
is it attitude? Like if the guy's a jerk or uncooperative, or maybe
I think that's
up
the
too
biggest
much,
thing.
Or?
I think that's the biggest thing. It's the biggest problem that we've had is attitude, yeah, especially in these things. I mean, you don't pay them enough. I kind of get it. So I never yell at people. Maybe one day I'll have millions and I could yell at somebody. Not even they're yelling at me, really. Yeah. You know. But yeah, it's mostly attitude because we all understand we're there for at this level. We're there for the picture, and everyone's very passionate and very generous with their time, and everyone's pretty much respectful. So when that little negative, you know, attitude comes out, and you know, when you're up against the clock, you know, everyone gets stressed out. So that's natural, you know. So we're very understanding. But yeah, I think that's that and safety. I think, you know, you got to be safe, and if that doesn't work. You know, you don't need them around.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, it's amazing how one person having a crappy attitude could kill a set.
Yeah.
I mean, really, just take a whole set down.
Yeah. And like I said, with the sound department, that was learned early on when we were just interviewing. And it was just that one person. And we, in retrospect, we think, you know, if that one person was on, how it would have affected the entire, you know, crew or the whole family, basically, because you're a family for those few days. And, you know, the dynamic shifts so quickly, you know. And so we were very, very lucky to have some solid guys working hard, you know. And mistakes are going to happen, you know, and everyone's not at the top of their game, at least with the thing that we had, that project. I mean, people were still learning. We had to take a few takes because of focus, you know, or whatever. We don't have motion control. So you have to, you know, it's all like it's hard, but. It feels really special when you get through it and you do it and you just at the end of the day, you breathe a big sigh and you go, I can't believe it. We did it with just these tools, you know. So there you go.
Wow. Dale, I'm so proud of you.
Oh, please. Yeah, wait. No.
Really, I was in film school with Dale. So
that's right.
That's how far back we go. We were in a film workshop one together.
I wasn't even in film during that time, remember?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I remember that. So I remember, and I always thought, who's that guy that makes all those really cool, really cool movies with the John Tesh soundtrack?
Yes, yeah. Oh, boy.
Okay, that was before he was Okay, I guess he never really was cool.
Yeah, exactly. come on, we love John.
All right. Well, hey, you know, I wanted to bring Dale on because that's actually a really good place if you really want to get into audio and you want to start your career. You know, Dale shoots a ton, but there's a lot of directors out there at that level where they're getting money to get the projects, and you know, they may not be the big blockbusters, but they're working and they're moving and they're selling, and it's really I can't tell you how many times, you know, I see people looking for crew and looking for sound guys. And if you are a good location guy, but you will be in demand because good location guys they're hard to find, aren't they? I mean, they're really hard to find.
And you know, one thing I'll throw into that is there's a handful of companies. There aren't that many. Coffee Sound, Location Sound Services in LA, Gotham and New York, a couple in Florida. Really look at the technologies they have. It's very boutique audio, but everything from radio mics, lavs, trams, you know, and what works well, and shotgun mics. There's a lot of stuff on YouTube. There's a lot of things you can read up on, but it is a very boutique style of audio, and you have to, it's everything's live, so you've got to be able to do it quickly and reliably, and it is amazing at how many. You know, some people think just put a mic out there and you'll get it, except for when they do different camera perspectives.
Yeah.
You don't want to hear the sound change perspective. So if you got a big room to a close-up to a medium shot, you actually don't want to hear the sound doing that.
That's so true.
Because then it starts bringing attention to the cut.
Mm-hmm. Well, it makes the edit more noticeable.
It makes the mix hellacious.
I did a little indie for a friend of mine, and they... The guy, I don't know why, but didn't use any radio mics. So he had all these perspective shots, and every take, there was a perspective change. So he's like, well, can you get the reverb off some of that? And I'm like, there is no reverb. That's a 20-foot distance on a mic.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, it was fun. For me, it was challenging to figure out how to get rid of it, and it wasn't easy. But, yeah, and I said, who's your sound guy? You know, and you gotta, you know, it is. I think it's very important in film, whether you're making YouTube videos or anything, it's not that hard, but learn to do it right.
Yeah.
And it'll pay tenfold.
What I also learned too is in post and score, because a couple of things that I worked on were this found footage, which is very similar to the Chernobyl thing.
Well, actually, Chernobyl, it's more like a. It's not really found food. It's not like a paranormal activity.
Yeah.
It's actually, but anyway.
It comes from that whole spirit of it. And I worked on something with the post sound, and not only was it just cleaning up, we were able to, once it went into mix and all that, is correcting so much. I mean, we were able to correct performances and make so many changes that improved the film, you know, from where it was originally, and it just makes a significant difference. I mean, there's just no question. I mean, even the producers, I said, you know, you have enough money to do it and get it in the can. That's one challenge, but you cannot. You know, there was a certain amount of budget allocated for post, and you know, you start going over budget, you start tapping that, and you know, you do what you got to do. But we had to make sure that you still got money for post, or else. What good is it? You can't finish it. You can't polish it. So there's still, you know, we have that to, we have priorities for sound and color and all that too. So it's so important post, you know.
Yeah, I was going to mention something about the reverb because you said that actually the room. I just saw a plugin from this company called Synaptics.
Yeah, it takes some reverb out.
Unveil. It basically removes...
Really? Someone finally does that?
Well, actually, a friend of mine told me that this was already available in the Sonic Works package. It's the same people. They split and they created a new company. But this plugin looks very easy to use. And I was showing it to a friend of mine. Actually, that does a lot of videos, and he thought this is really cool because you can remove the ambience, or you can actually remove, for example, you're moving a bag with peanuts or something in the room, and it totally preserves the transients, but it removes the ambience. Or you can do the opposite; you can totally expose the reverb and remove the transients. So it's very useful to do this change of perspective.
What was the name of it?
It's called Unveil, UNVI, from Synaptic, German company.
About wow, maybe about 3 years ago in New York, the AES show, there was a Japanese company that had a plugin that did that. I actually talked about it on the podcast. It was really expensive. It was like $1,800.
Oh, no, this is more like in the usual range of plugins. Yeah, so why I think it might be very popular.
Yeah.
That sounds really cool.
Because I would have liked to have gotten that, but $1,800 for a plugin that just takes reverb is kind of steep.
Yeah.
But this one, you know, I always thought, well, if somebody did it, someone's going to come along and do it better.
Yeah, they have nice demos online. You can check them out.
That's like the holy grail.
And also for creative, not just to actually do sound design, but also to create something new out of it. Because you take a sound and you remove something out of it. There's an example with an ambience. It basically makes it from, make it from super ambient, super wide to more focused. So
and what's it called? Zenaptics?
Yeah.
Synaptic, yeah.
It's the company. And Unveil is the name of the...
Probably Unveil.
Yeah.
Yeah. We ended up using one of those as well as WNS and Isotope. Mm-hmm. Really helps a lot.
Cool. I'm going to... Sorry, I was actually...
Right there.
Yep, I see it. Oh, I'm going to buy it. It's sold. Sold.
Does it say how much it is? Or?
Well, let's see. As long as we're here, let's find out.
Be a sponsor of the show.
I will say also for any kind of dialogue, Isotope RX 2.
Oh,
Is a standard.
Oh, yeah. Oh. $269.
Sold.
If I'm going to buy that tonight. If you're a mixer out there and you,
that's what I'm saying.
That's like that has to be a tool. You just have to go buy it.
Yeah, I mean, when you listen to the demo, you realize instantly how interesting it's very simple. If you look at the
that's phenomenal. Yeah. That's like
And it sounds
Speechless. He's speechless.
I'm going to cry. No, the reason why is because I'm on a mix where I have exactly what Scott was talking about. I have these mics, and they were perspective mics, and they're changing perspective, and the audio is changing the perspective also. And one of the shots is nothing but room tone as the guy is walking forward.
Well, but there's a demo of a Walla recorded, and they basically bring people front in the front, and then they push it back. It's insane. Wow. It really works. It's very effective when you listen to the demo. You
know? Oh, this is awesome! As a matter of fact, it's $269 before June. After June, it's going up to $399.
Get in there quick.
Yeah,
I will. I'm going to buy this tonight because I need this. But great,
good.
See, I love this podcast just for this kind of stuff. All right. Well, hey, listen, we're running a little long. Dale, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate it. Good luck. Let's give Dale a nice looking forward to many more films from you. But before we go, anybody have anything they've been working on? Anything they want to talk about?
I certainly do. I didn't talk about it earlier, and I'll go into more details as the weeks and months go on, but I am in the midst of probably the music project that I've been the most excited about in my career in at least a few decades. This is a good one. I am, and I'm going to put a call out for some assistance from our listener base, actually, but the short version of the story is I'm developing and producing a new artist. He's a 15-year-old singer, dancer, performer, extraordinaire type. And we are just now, we've been formulating the project for the last few months, and I've said I was working on something, but I couldn't talk about details. That is what it is. It's his project. And by the end of the summer, we're going to bring him out with at least an EP and maybe more. But we're doing the project completely independently. But if things go the way they're going now, it's going to be pretty big. And if not, I'll tell you why later in the summer. But no, it's going incredibly well. And one of the things I wanted to put out the call for, a lot of the music is going to be sort of dance, next generation dance music. And if we have any producers out there who think they have the next great sound for dance music, or they know of someone who does, or their neighbor's kid does, or whatever, we're looking for fresh, amazing new sounds and great new producers. Well, hook me up. We need songs too, but it's we have a lot of great writers on the project, and actually Bobby Summerfield's working with me on it.
Wow.
a lot of people are working on it. And it's just an amazing project. I am really, really, really excited. And I don't get excited too much anymore. No, this is a really, really good one. This is a really good one. I mean, for considering he's only 15, I've never met anybody as sort of naturally talented and as hardworking. Pretty impressive.
Nice.
I think everyone will be impressed. But so, yeah, if they can get in touch through the Facebook page or just I'm looking for tracks. Any songs, if you send in songs, they've got to be copyrighted. I won't listen to anything that isn't copyrighted. We have that whole unsolicited material problem, which if you listen to previous podcasts, we've talked about that. You don't want to send uncopyrighted material. But I'm mostly interested in whatever that next dance sound is. Like, think what LMFAO was when they first hit. Think of what people think about David Guetta.
Yeah,
I need the next David Guetta.
Zydeco.
Yeah. Well, it's not too late to get involved with this one. And the podcast is, this will post within the next few weeks, right? So it's still going to be plenty of time when this posts. So get in touch. So I am very excited about that. That's what I'm working on.
Awesome. I'm looking forward to hearing more about that.
And you shall.
Scott, anything?
I
guess you kind of set it out at the beginning.
Yeah, I'm pretty much locking myself in my room. I don't actually get out much these days and very, very focused.
Nice.
Well, I'm working on something that I'm going to be going to New York at the Vimeo Film Festival. DTS asked me to do a presentation of my stuff, you know, so I'm going to show some videos, some techniques and this and that. And I have an idea in mind. I don't want to say too much now, but if I can pull it off, it's going to be really nice. But so next trip, New York City.
Nice.
New York's always fun.
Cool. Yeah.
Well, I won't have too much time, actually. We fly in the day before, we do the thing, and we fly out. But, you know.
You got to have dinner at least?
Yeah, definitely.
And Mike, what are you doing?
Not much. Just kind of hanging out.
Buying a new plugin, maybe tonight.
Buying a new plugin.
But you had an honor.
I did have an honor. It was kind of fun. I won a Clio, nice. Which was good for sound design on a teaser trailer for Prey 2.
Very nice.
Worked on that with Henry Boy, and that was kind of fun.
Congrats.
Pretty cool.
So that'll be kind of fun. That's a nice little, you know, little thing for the resume.
Nice.
But it was fun, and it was a good honor. Worked with some really good creatives. So anyway. Well, hey, listen, if you have any comments or questions about my Clio, you can reach me. Wait. No, sorry. No, if you have any comments or questions about the show, you can reach us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com. That's audio@nowcastnetwork.com. And you can also catch us on our Facebook page. And just want to let everybody know that there's some really cool things that are going to be happening. Ken Scott's going to be coming back because we just didn't have enough time to spend with him. And we got to talk about all the Bowie stuff. I mean, there's that man is just so full of just history and knowledge, and there's all kinds of stuff. And so I'm going to be working with Bobby. We're going to get Ken back on after the book drops, and that'll be kind of fun. So we want to let him know. As well as we've got some other guests that are lining up for June and for July that'll be kind of fun. A little different from what we've done, but definitely musical. We're probably going to have a whole band come in and join us, which will be kind of fun. And there's some names on in the band that will be here. I'm not going to say anything other than just tease it like that. But just want to thank everybody for listening. And once again, if you have any comments or questions, you can reach us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com. That's audio@nowcastnetwork.com. For myself and all the guys, thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.
Woo!
Listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by API and Westwave Audio. The Audio Nowcast is hosted by Mike Rodriguez and uses AFEX's 230 Master Channel Voice Processor. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.